Okay, good afternoon. This is a continuing session on Transiting Planets as seen from the ground and from Spitzer. I'm Carl Stoppelfeld from JPL. I'll be your session chair. Our first talk to kick things off, Josh Wynn from MIT, Patterns and Puzzles in Transit Observables.
Thank you, Carl. And thank you also to Adam and Kristen and David for the opportunity to visit KITP and to speak to you about some of the things we can learn from very precise observations of transits and occultations. I'll be reviewing the work of a lot of people, but I want to pay special thanks to the people I've worked most closely with, Josh Carter and Simon Albrecht, my group at MIT, John Johnson, Andrew Howard, and Jeff Marcy, Dan Fabricki and Matt Holman, and Norio Narita. So as I said, I'm going to be talking about some of the things we can learn when we follow the transits and the occultations of the planets with high precision photometry and spectroscopy as the planet is hidden by the star and then as it comes around again into view. And I keep a list of all the things that have been proposed that we might learn from transits and occultations. It's a growing list. A lot of it is borrowed from the literature on eclipsing binaries, as Dave mentioned this morning, and it ranges from the mundane to the far-fetched. Now, a lot of these have actually already been done. And this afternoon, I've selected just a small subset of these things to discuss today. And a lot of very exciting work on the atmospheres will be discussed later this afternoon by Heather Knutson and by Giovanna Tinetti. So, first, I realize not all of you here live and breathe transits, so I have a little bit of Transits 101. This is our beloved transit light curve. And the only reason that the bottom here is curved rather than flat is because of the limb darkening of the star. But in Transits 101, we neglect that. And so you get to measure four things very cleanly: the depth of the transit, the duration of the transit, the partial duration, the duration of ingress or egress, and the midpoint of the transit time. Now, from the depth and the durations, you can construct three dimensionless parameters that relate to the system: the radius ratio, the impact parameter, and the radius of the star in units of the orbital distance, if you also know the orbital period. These equations are simplified for a non-grazing small planet on a circular orbit, but they're easy enough to generalize. Now, these dimensionless parameters are great, but usually what you really want to know is the mass of the planet in kilograms, or the radius of the planet in kilometers. And for that, you have to supplement these parameters with some external information about the star, its mass, its radius, from the stellar spectrum, from astroseismology, as we heard this morning, whatever you've got. But interestingly, if you're willing to trust Kepler's law, then you can construct two parameters with dimensions from these. Those are the mean density of the star and the surface gravity of the planet, where this k here is the velocity semi-amplitude of the Doppler orbit. So that, in effect, when you're doing precise observations of transits and occultations, what you're really measuring is the mean density of the star and the surface gravity of the planet. Now, the mean density of the star is very useful because it gives you a fix on the mass and radius of the star, and therefore of the planet. So here's some examples from Torres et al. Basically, the mean density is a superior alternative to the usual log g parameter that's derived from spectroscopy. Here, for the case of WASP-2, the effective temperature and log g don't give you much information about where you are on these stellar isochrones for this particular star, but when you use the mean density instead, you have a much better fix on where you are here, and therefore on the mass and the radius of the star and of the planet. A very important test of this method was recently performed by Tim Brown. What he did was he took 156 double-lined eclipsing binaries for which we know the mass and the radius within a few percent, without many modeling assumptions. And he pretended that all he knew was the mean density of the star, as if he had seen a transit across one of them, along with the effective temperature and the metallicity from the spectrum. And what he found is he was able to recover the radii of these stars with an RMS error of 2.6%. So at least for stars more massive than the sun, the ones that completely dominated the sample, the limiting error in the radii and masses of the planets that we can get using this method is a few percent. Now, I mentioned you can also learn the surface gravity of the planet without external assumptions. And that is obviously very important for the people who work at science museums. and who want to calibrate those scales that tell you exactly how much you weigh on other planets. We can do that. We might not be able to tell you the mass and the radius of the planet to better than 2 or 3%, but in some cases we know the surface gravity to a small fraction of a percent. Now, to my knowledge, that precision has never been used. It seems, I don't know exactly how you would, but it seems to me that we're missing an opportunity here to learn something. There's unexploited precision in our measurements, at least for some systems, that's not being taken advantage of. Now, it was once proposed that the surface gravities of the planets and their orbital periods for the transiting systems were correlated, this negative correlation here. You see the slope going downward. This correlation has actually weakened with time as more and more discoveries have filled in this region here, even with the giant planets. The correlation that still looks really good, though, is one that was proposed even earlier by Maza, Zucker, and Pont, relating the mass and the periods of the transiting planets, and more generally for the Doppler-detected planets. Where if you focus your attention on the giants, you see that there is what seems to be a lower envelope here that decreases. We don't find many planets with low mass at the shortest orbital periods. As far as I know, this too is an unsettled issue. It's been attributed to tidal effects, to evaporation, some kind of funny selection effect, but remains an unsettled issue. So that brings us to the masses and the radii of the planets. This is a figure that from Charbonneau et al. That we also saw this morning, reminding us that we have tons of giant planets, all of which are bigger, or most of which are bigger than Jupiter, along with three Neptune-like objects and two super-Earths. Now, I also keep a list of theories that have been proposed to explain these so-called loaded planets. And Dave did a very good job of teasing the theorists this morning for not being able to come up with predictive theories. And in that vein, let me just point out that the only theory in this list that has actually been ruled out was not ruled out because of a prediction, but just due to increased theoretical scrutiny. And I know that. I can say that without being rude, because that was the theory that Matt Holman and I proposed, the obliquity tides. So we have a long way to go before we can consider this problem to be solved, I feel. But it would certainly help if we could somehow look inside the planets and gain some information about their interior structures. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about how that might be done. Well, for stars, the way we do that is with apsidal precession. If a stellar binary has an elliptical orbit, then the orientation of that orbit will precess due to general relativity, due to the tidal bulge and the rotational oblateness of both bodies. Now, Darren Ragazine and Aaron Wolf noticed that for the case of close-in giant planets, the dominant effect comes from the tidal bulge of the planet. So you'll see that orbit precessing, and you can measure that through the transit and occultation times and durations. What you get to measure this way is the so-called Love number, K2, of the planet. That describes how centrally concentrated it is. It's really the ratio of the quadrupole potential of the squished planet to the imposed tidal potential of the star, with K2 of 0 being a point mass, a uniform density ball is 1.5, and Jupiter is about 0.5, 1/2. So here is a figure from their paper showing that for the closest in planets, the shortest period, the relative importance of the tidal bulge is very large and completely dominates the effect. The problem is that those exact same orbits should have been circularized by tidal dissipation, which would eliminate the opportunity to measure the apsidal precession. So it was very surprising when the planet WASP-12 was found to be on an eccentric orbit by its discoverers, despite the fact that its orbital period is only about 1 day. This is so close to its star that Li et al. Have recently argued that the planet is highly prolate and is overflowing its Roche lobe onto the star, and yet it still has a measurably eccentric orbit. This was confirmed through the detection of the occultation in ground-based photometry by Lopez Morales et al. What you get to measure that way is not E, but E cosine omega, where omega is the argument of pericenter, but they found that to be a few percent, a few sigma away from zero. Most recently, Campo et al. Weighed in with more precise photometry from the Spitzer Space Telescope. And they also measured E cos omega and found it to be an order of magnitude smaller, although still a few sigma away from zero. Now, one way to interpret this progression is precession. These were actually measurements taken at different times, and if you link them all together with a precession model, you can find a value for the K2 of the planet of 0.15 with a large error, which would be very significant because this is very centrally condensed compared to, say, Jupiter. On the other hand, and the authors, Campo et al., certainly recognize this, another way to interpret this progression is that ever more precise measurements will lead to ever smaller values for the eccentricity, and that we're being led astray here by systematic effects or some subtleties in the model fitting. But this is a measurement of such importance that it surely deserves to be repeated, since it may give us a glimpse inside the planet. Okay, now I want to spend a few minutes talking about rotational oblateness, a subject that came up during this morning's discussion. So Saturn is very oblate. Its polar diameter is 10% shorter than its equatorial diameter due to rotation. It would be great to measure the oblateness of exoplanets. And actually, there is a slight difference between the light curve of a spherical planet and the light curve of an oblate planet that has the same cross-sectional area. The problem, which was worked out by Seeger and Hui and Barnes and Fortney through calculations, is that those differences are super tiny. They only range to a few hundred parts per million. This is the light curve of an oblate planet minus the light curve of a best-fitting spherical model. So the differences only amount to a few hundred parts per million and only take place during the short times of ingress and egress. On the other hand, the precision of the space-based data that we have now has actually taken us to this level. So as part of his PhD thesis, Josh Carter looked at these seven Spitzer light curves of HD 189733 that had been gathered by Eric Agol and his collaborators and found that they were just sufficient to be able to test for a Saturn-like oblateness and obliquity. So what you get to measure is the obliquity, the tilt of the planet, and the oblateness, the flattening, as projected on the sky. That's what matters for the transit. And what he found was all that data was able to rule out this region of parameter space here. So we can tell that this planet is not as oblate as Saturn. Now that's very exciting to a diehard empiricist like me, but on the other hand, there's a very strong theoretical presumption that this planet is so close to its star that its orbital period has been, that its spin period has been synchronized with its orbital period, which is much slower than that of Saturn. So the theorists would have expected the oblateness to come in down there, undetectably small. There is, however, another observable effect of oblateness, and that's spin precession. So here is another piece of work by Josh Carter, who recognized that if because of the force from the star torquing on the rotational bulge of the planet, that will cause the spin axis of the planet to precess. Now, the precession periods for Jupiter and Saturn are millions of years, but if they're really close into their stars, those precession periods are measured in years to decades. And the consequence of that is that the silhouette of the planet is changing slightly with time, and you would see that as transit depth variations. So over time, the spin precession of a planet like Saturn would have transit depth variations of order a few percent. And we predict that Kepler will be able to measure this effect for giant planets with periods of about 15 to 30 days, which they should be able to find plenty of. This is short enough, that's close enough to the star for the precession to be relatively rapid, but far enough away that you wouldn't expect the spin orbit synchronization. So we're looking forward to being able to do this. Next, we come to the stellar obliquity. So now we're talking about the star's spin axis and its orientation with respect to the planetary orbit. That's the stellar obliquity. The background here is that the sun's obliquity is 7 degrees, and we would like to know how typical or unusual that is compared to the exoplanets. Now, for the exoplanets, we actually have some very specific reasons to expect misalignments, at least occasionally. We know a lot of them have eccentric orbits, and whatever is perturbing those eccentricities will also perturb the inclinations. And for the close-in planets in particular, we wonder whether orbital migration would perturb those inclinations. The different theories for migration make different predictions about this. For example, disk migration, that is, tidal inspiral through the disk, would tend to damp out the inclinations so that even if they started large, they would end small. Whereas planet-planet scattering, followed by tidal circularization, would produce a very broad range of final inclinations for those planets through the randomization of the scattering. And Kozai cycles, along with tidal friction, would produce a very broad range, even broader than the scattering model, of final inclinations. So how do we measure the stellar obliquity? The way is, we don't think of a star like this. Instead, we think of it like this. The star is rotating. And so the approaching half of the star looks a little bit blue if you have on your Doppler shift glasses. and the receding half looks a little bit red. And usually that's just produces an overall line broadening. But if the planet is stepping across the blue shifted side, then you'll see an anomalous red shift, which then vanishes when the planet crosses the symmetry axis of the star and changes direction when it steps over the receding half of the star. So you see this pattern of anomalous Doppler shift, which is in turn superimposed on the overall orbital motion of the star, the way that we detect the planets in the first place. So a fancy way to say what I've just said is that the transiting planet knocks out a few of the velocity components that usually contribute to the rotational broadening kernel. And this is just what we need, because if the planet and the star are aligned like this, you get this anti-symmetric waveform. But if the planet is tipped at some crazy angle and is spending all of its time covering the redshifted half, you only observe an anomalous blue shift. So we measure this, and we infer this. And this was first predicted in the context of eclipsing binaries by J.R. Holt, and measured subsequently by Frank Schlesinger. So we call it the Holt-Schlesinger effect. Oh, no, wait a minute. Life is not fair, and neither is our terminology. It is, in fact, called the Rossiter-McLaughlin effect, and that's the tool that we use for these measurements. So here is some typical data from our program, by which I mean, of course, this is the best data we have ever obtained, possibly ever will obtain. It's a very favorable system, HD189733. It does have that anti-symmetric character. So up here is the photometric transit, of course, and this is the spectroscopic transit. And the character of that blip tells us that the angle lambda, that's the angle on the sky between the stellar rotation axis and the orbital axis of the planet, is no more than a few degrees. So this has also been measured with HARPS with even greater precision by Amaury Triaud and his group, who are also pursuing this technique. So this is a very well-aligned system. This is some genuinely typical data. So this is a fainter star, it's not rotating as rapidly, the transit is not as deep, and so the data are noisier. But you can still see it has that same up-down character as the other example did, and so this is another example of a well-aligned system. Well, things really got interesting after XO3 was discovered. This is a planet with a relatively large mass and a high eccentricity. So if you're wondering if the inclinations and the eccentricities are linked, this is a good system to pursue. And in fact, the Swiss team measured the spectroscopic effect throughout a transit and saw that throughout the transit, there was apparently only a blue shift that was observed without the corresponding red shift. And this is something that we saw the same pattern with at using the Keck Observatory. And if you fit a model to this, we got a value of lambda of about 37 degrees. That is much larger than any of the orbital inclinations inside the solar system. Next one I want to highlight is the extraordinary case of HD 80606 with an outrageous eccentricity of 0.93. This eccentricity has been attributed to the Kozai effect, which would also tilt the orbit of the planet. So this would be a great system to check on whether the Kozai effect has actually been operating by measuring the Rossiter-McLaughlin effect. Now, this was a Doppler-detected planet. It was discovered back in 2001 and was not known to transit until more recently. And that's because Greg Laughlin, who had been obsessing over this planet for some years, used his magic powers to cause it to transit, and then encouraged all of us to go out and seek evidence for that, which we in fact did. So through a big community-wide effort, a bunch of people pasted together the unusually long 12-hour duration transit of this thing. And we also collected velocities with Keck and this Geneva group with SOFI throughout part of the transit to establish that at mid-transit, we saw a blue shift, and that can only happen if this system is misaligned. So we don't have a very good fix on lambda, but we know that it's not small. So that brings me to my favorite one, which is HAT-P7, discovered by our next speaker, Gáspár Bakos. Here is the spectroscopic transit, and by now you're probably well enough trained to notice that there is something peculiar about this. This one goes down and then up, so it is not like this, as I've been showing. Instead, it's like this. Lambda comes out to be close to 180 degrees. So the north pole of the star and the north pole of the orbit are pointing in very nearly opposite directions as we see them on the sky. So this may be an example of a retrograde orbit for a close-in planet, which is very exciting, but there is a catch. Everything is done in sky projection, as I've tried to be careful about saying all along. So the situation could be like this, where the planet and the star are rotating in opposite directions. Or it could be like this, with the star's pole pointing nearly at us, but in the sky projection, the north pole of the star and the north pole of the orbit are still pointing oppositely. So we don't know exactly what the true angle is, but we know that it's greater than the true angle between those vectors, greater than 86.7 degrees. So it's a highly tilted orbit. Excellent. There are some more retrograde systems coming. This is a publication by Anderson et al. Based on observations by the Geneva group. But I learned 1 hour ago from Amaury Triaud that they have four other misaligned systems that they're just about ready to announce. So that's something to look forward to during the discussion. So these things are apparently not very rare. But you might wonder if we see any pattern to these measurements. We've done more than 20 of these measurements. So what can we say about what's going on? Well, it's not clear. So here I plotted lambda, the thing we're measuring, as a function of the planet mass, which ranges very broadly. And I've color-coded the dots to indicate which ones are circular and which ones have eccentric orbits. And there's no really clear pattern, I would say. There's some tendency for the ones on eccentric orbits to be misaligned, that is, away from zero here. And for a while, we thought that when we only had these three, that all the massive eccentric ones would be found to be misaligned. But then these three were found and sort of complicate the picture. In fact, I would say the only really clear trend that we see based on the data that I'm aware of is this one, where you plot it as a function of the order of announcement of the measurement. They were all aligned for a while. And then last summer, we had some kind of an event, and we were finding misaligned systems everywhere. And that seems to have subsided now, although Amaury will share with us a second peak that has come into view here. So the upshot, although I don't know, I haven't discerned any real pattern here, is that I think that disk migration cannot be the whole story. Since we're finding these things and they're not rare, disk migration doesn't seem to produce them. And Dan Fabricy and I wrote a paper at a time when we only knew about the systems up to about here and concluded that there were probably two modes of planet migration, because there were a lot of well-aligned systems and then some outliers that could not plausibly be explained as the tail of some distribution. So maybe there's more than one way to create hot Jupiters, and maybe that's what this is telling us. Okay, I want to spend the last few minutes on another interesting system, HAT-P13, because it brings together a lot of the things that I've been discussing. So this, too, was discovered by our next speaker, Gashpar. It was exciting because it has a transiting planet, but also another low-mass object in a more distant orbit, companion C here. And it's a very eccentric orbit. And furthermore, planet B's orbit, the transiting planet, seems to be slightly eccentric as well, with a significance of a few sigma. The exciting thing about this is it may give us an avenue to measuring the Love number, that is the interior structure of planet B, but through a completely different pathway. The idea goes back to Wu and Goldreich, and also Rosemary Mardling, who explained what happens when you have a two-planet system like this one. First of all, the outer planet, through its interaction with the inner planet, delays the circularization of the inner planet. They both end up in a situation where they're apsidally locked, so the eccentric orbits are precessing together. And then in the fullness of time, both orbits are circularized, but it spends a long time in this state where they're apsidally locked. So how does this help? Well, Batygin et al. And Mardling also looked and recognized HAT-P13 as a possible example of this system. In fact, it's kind of funny that the theory that was developed by Wu and Goldreich was developed for a planetary system that turned out not to exist. It was a spurious detection. But it's the hallmark of a brilliant theory that it's able to transcend that spurious detection and be applied to HAT-P13, as was done here. So the idea is that the precession rate of the outer orbit can be calculated. You can measure everything you need to calculate that precession rate. The precession rate of the inner planet depends on some things you can measure, but also on K2. And so if you assume that they're equal, you get to learn K2. And that's great. So this is a figure from Batygin et al. That shows that if, depending on the eccentricity of that inner planet, you can figure out what K2 is from this condition that they're apsidally locked, and therefore figure out whether it has a massive core or no core at all, for example. However, Rosemary looked at this in a little more detail more recently and found that there's actually one thing that you don't get to measure that will be very difficult to measure, and that's the mutual inclination between the orbits. Instead of settling down into a constant eccentricity in the case of non-coplanar orbits, the eccentricity bobs around. And what's going on there is the eccentricity and the angle between the apsides are no longer settling to a fixed number, but are circulating around in parameter space. And so if you don't know the mutual inclination, this is for a particular choice of mutual inclination, if you don't know what that is, then the party is over and you can't perform this method. Well, the most recent chapter is that if this is the photometric transit of the inner planet, but if the orbits are really mutually inclined, if delta I is large, then you would also expect this angle lambda to be non-zero. You'd expect it to be misaligned with the star. And that's just because of precession. If they're really misaligned, the interplanetary orbit is going to be precessing around the momentum of the system, which is dominated by that outer companion. So we have just measured this, though, and found that it is, in fact, well aligned. So lambda is small for this system. Within it still has an error of plus or minus 9 degrees, but at least the system has passed this one test. If we had found this system also to be misaligned, then as I said before, I don't think that this method would have been applicable. Nevertheless, this measurement of lambda does not tell us the mutual inclination. It just suggests that it's probably small. The outcome is less definitive in this case. The finding that it was aligned is less definitive in this case. So we still need to know the actual value of the mutual inclination. So how are we going to do that? Well, one possibility is through transit timing variations of the inner planet. But unfortunately, the dependence of those timing anomalies on the mutual inclination is small, and so you'll have to do it very precisely with an accuracy of 5 or 10 seconds. Another possibility, if we're really lucky, planet C, the outer one planet, might transit. That hasn't been checked either way, and the next opportunity to do so is about a month from now. So we have to hope that Greg Laughlin will use his magic powers again and cause planet C to transit, and if we measure the Rossiter effect for that planet too, then we'll get a really good measurement of the mutual inclination. And that's where I'll stop. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Josh. First question from Jack here.
Very nice. Finding out these detailed properties of planets based on interaction of observed planets. I'm wondering how big a third object, an unseen planet, could be to really throw a monkey wrench in this?
Well, the direct answer to your question is I don't know. But one thing that I do know that I clipped off is that this system does have a third body in it that we found. So just through additional radio velocity monitoring, these are the velocities as a function of time, you see planet B is causing these bobbing around here, and planet C is this overall eccentricity. But the two-planet model is no longer a good fit to these data. These are the residuals, which show these strong correlated patterns. And these residuals go away if you add a component D with some long period. So there definitely is a third companion to this star. And Rosemary will tell us what effect it has on this scenario.
OK, a question over here.
So I just want to make a cautionary note, and actually this has been pointed out a number of times, but I've been doing some work with my graduate student, Jason Eastman, on trying to see how well we can actually infer non-zero eccentricities for small eccentricities. And like I said, this has been pointed out very many times, but it turns out to be extremely difficult. And furthermore, it also depends quite strongly on what you assume for your prior and the eccentricities. In the case of WASP-12, we find that, you know, depending on what you assume for your prior, it's the radial velocity orbit and the secondary eclipse is completely consistent with a circular orbit. And the other thing I want to, and so I don't think there's any real, the only strong evidence for non-zero eccentricity in that system is the Lopez-Morales secondary eclipse timing, and in that case, even they argue that, you know, it might be some systematic effect in the relatively low signal-to-noise detection. And the other thing I want to point out is something else Jason Eastman realized, is that people are generally using somewhat inconsistent timestamps for their transit photometry, and this can actually have an effect that's as large as 60 seconds, or it can be a few seconds, depending on exactly what timestamp they're using. Just be careful about that, because this can also cause people to disagree on values of the eccentricity.
Amen.
Next question here.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, this is to report that, as Josh said, we got four more retrograde planets within the HARPS search. That when we transform the angle that the aligned, or rather the projected angle that lambda that you can measure from the Rossiter-McLaughlin effect into a probability of an obliquity, we actually find that 80% of hot Jupiters should be misaligned and reproduce very well in the models by Fabricius and Tremain using cosine migration. Actually, I don't see any indications for type 1 or 2 migrations for hot Jupiters. I've got plots if you want to see.
Matyachuk, so far you've been speculating that something happened to the planet and induced inclination, but also the star might have something happening.
True.
And in some of these systems, I mean, it's certainly true for our solar system, the angular momentum is in the planets, not the star. So have you tried plotting things against the angular momentum division, or is there any trend?
I don't think we have enough information to separate those two things. I guess all we measure is the relative angle between those two vectors. I guess what you're asking is, if we had a multi-planet system, can we tell the difference between the total angular momentum vector of the whole system and the star?
No, like, have you looked at the fraction of the angular momentum that's in the planet versus the star, if that matters?
No, I haven't made that plot.
So what's the source of the observation time versus inclination correlation? And as a corollary to that question,
that peak.
Yes.
Yeah.
So can you say with confidence what the ratio between the aligned and misaligned systems is now?
So you're asking, why did we suddenly find all those misaligned systems after several years of well-aligned systems?
Yes.
I really don't know. Yeah, I know the only remark I have that might shed some light on this is that sometimes we have a suspicion, for one reason or another, that a system might be misaligned, and so we propose to observe that one. That was the case for HAT-P7. So John Johnson noticed that the V sine I for that star, the projected rotation rate, was kind of small, given the type of star it is, as if it were observed kind of close to pole on. And so we put special attention on that system, found it to be misaligned. So maybe our intuitions about which systems are misaligned got better. I sort of doubt it. That's all I can say.
So given that, with what confidence can you say what the ratio between the two populations is?
I don't know. We'll have to wait in another year or so and see how the situation settles out.
Actually, when you take the theoretical predictions by Fabricius and Tremain and transform them into observable angles, you find that 55 to 60% of planets should be measured aligned. That's about what we have now. It matches the observations. Yeah, yeah. Well, the theory transformed to observations. I match also the observations to the theory. Either way, really. Seems natural.
So that last remark impels me to ask a question that I asked you privately again in public. In principle, for these transiting planets, if we could only measure the rotation period of the star photometrically and compare with the V sine I, then we could get the angle of the star's rotation out of the plane of the sky. Could you comment on the prospects for doing that?
Well, that has been done for one system, HD189733. And that's because it was a favorable case. It's a spotted star, so it's easy to measure those rotational modulations. I don't think it's been done for any other system, because most of these stars are hot stars. They're not supposed to have spots, and they don't have any observed photometric variability. For the particular case of HAT-P7, we're very fortunate that it's in the field of view of the Kepler satellite. So we will get a good measurement of its rotation period. We will be able to do astroseismology, which in principle can tell us the inclination of the star with respect to the line of sight. But for the other systems, I'd say the prospects are not good.
Yeah, so you mentioned that processing oblate planet could cause variations in the transit light curve. Could it also cause an effect on the thermal phase variations in the infrared?
I suppose. I haven't thought about that. I mean, the ones for which you can measure those thermal phase curves are the close-in planets, which are not supposed to be oblate and oblique. But if it were, I suppose there would be some difference. That's, you know, the fractional change would be proportional to the oblateness.
Yeah, Josh, you mentioned two modes of planet formation, mm-hmm. but you didn't elaborate on that. It got me a bit intrigued because it seems to me that it's consistent with what we're seeing with a stochastic model in which you form several planets. They may interact, they may get high inclinations or not, and the inclination is damped very slowly by tides.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much time I have, but I do have a few slides about exactly what Dan and I did. It's a very empirical study. We weren't thinking of any particular migration mechanisms. All we did is we said, given the data, we can model it in one of two ways. Either they're all drawn from some smooth distribution, and we use the Fisher distribution, which is like a little Gaussian on a sphere with one parameter that morphs from a very concentrated distribution to a very isotropic distribution. So maybe all of the spin orbit angles are drawn from that distribution. Or maybe they're drawn from a two-component model where a fraction of them are completely isotropic and the other fraction are perfectly well aligned. And this model also has one parameter. So you can test them against each other in a Bayesian sense. And this one is preferred by many orders of magnitude. And I think that's just a fancy way of saying that there are some major outliers in the distribution of lambda that cannot plausibly be explained as the tail of some distribution. And that's even after you take the sky projection into effect. That's, I think, the only subtle thing about that statement. Is that's why we did this fancy calculation, is to take that into account. Yeah. So the idea is that the two-component model is preferred, but we don't know what those models are. We're just saying from the data, it seems that there are two different distributions merged.
I have a question about the obliquities. I would expect the obliquities of those planets which are close enough to transit generally would have been damped to zero. Is there any other reason why you would expect those obliquities not to be zero?
The really close-in ones should be damped to zero. So the prospects for measuring those effects are going to have to be for more distant planets. And usually the usual timescale arguments for that synchronization process to happen, that should happen in periods of about 15 to 30 days. So if the planets are that far out, there's at least some chance that they're still rotating very quickly.
This is Jeff Marcy. In the spirit of discussion, may I engage Amaury Trio? Yes. Twisting your head around. I think your statement was that something like 80% of the transiting planets might have been brought in by COSI. Is that your idea, basically?
Well, when I transform the observed angle into the real angle statistically, I see a distribution that is bimodal. There is one peak at around 40 degrees and another at 120. That's fully consistent with one mode of migration through COSI. So it's actually the model and the observation fit so precisely, it's really impressive.
So my question is, there are many other properties of the hot Jupiters that such a model would have to satisfy. For example, the hot Jupiters tend to be lower mass, less than a Jupiter mass, and almost all of the hot Jupiters don't have a known second Jupiter mass companion out to, say, several AUs where we would have detected them. Are those two properties consistent with a predominantly COSI mechanism for all the hot Jupiters?
Well, I'm not a theoretician. My observation only show that type 1 or 2 migration doesn't seem to agree with my observations. I fitted the best model, which was the COSI migration. I just plotted over my data. Now, what I've understood of the COSI mechanism is that if it happens, the most massive planet will survive in the system. Now, it's alone, and a binary companion might be somewhere around. COSI seems to be working out up to 1500 AUs, which would place the secondary several seconds, if not minutes, away from the primary to observe it in the sky. And I think most people who've been looking for secondaries only looked a few seconds away. To do it like half a minute away, you need observations and a bit of time to make sure that the proper motion associates the binary to the primary.
If I might add a comment, the fact that the hot Jupiters don't seem to have many other longer period companions compared to stars that don't have hot Jupiters is actually kind of consistent with the COSI picture, because the presence of an outer planet might spoil that Kozai resonance. In fact, usually does.
Dr. Scott?
Just a quick comment slash question. I think that, you know, it's certainly the case that we have evidence that planets migrate via the disk because we see planets in resonance. So I don't think we're ever going to be able to say that it's just one mechanism or another.
Did you try to separate your sample to come back on your two modes results? Because we could think that there are planets formed in a disk that should be more aligned, for example, brown dwarfs, which should form by gravitational collapse, and that would be much more massive. So did you try, for example, one sample with without the massive planets?
No, we didn't for this paper. In fact, the reason I really didn't show this slide is because it's not completely up to date. It doesn't take in all the latest discoveries. The time we wrote it, there was really only one massive planet that you could play with. So it will start to make sense to split up the sample like that over time.
Okay. A similar question, is there any relationship between how puffy the hot Jupiters are and whether they're in one of these two populations?
That's a good question, but I don't know.
Yeah. May I ask a question about this plot of the mass of hot Jupiters against the orbital period? You showed this plot of Tsui Maatse.
Yes.
There an explanation for this relation?
There are proposed explanations, but I would say there's no definitive explanation.
What is the proposed explanation?
Well, one proposal is that the reason you don't find low-mass planets at short periods is because they evaporate more quickly from the irradiation due to the host star. Another idea, which was Frederic Pontz, is that it's evidence for some tidal evolution. I don't remember exactly how it works, but through exchange of angular momentum with the star. So the idea is that all hot Jupiters park at exactly the same orbital period, but then they get spread out in this characteristic way through an interaction with the star and an exchange of angular momentum. Does anybody else have any other theories to add? Maybe I should keep a list.
Josh, Gilles Chabrier. I just want to make a small comment. Coming back to the misalignment fraction of exoplanets you've just shown, it's very interesting, and it's something you didn't mention, but you know perfectly that most, I mean, the vast majority of the transiting systems do not have enough total angular momentum for the planet to reach a stable orbit. As a matter of fact, the fate of the vast majority of these planets will be a final merging with the stars. In that case, because there is not enough total angular momentum in the system, even though you expect the eccentricity to be done very, very quickly, as Stan pointed out, the time scale for the evolution of the rosita of the obliquity is the same as the time scale of the evolution of the orbit itself, which is the lifetime of the system itself. So even though a Kozai mechanism will help, definitely, you don't need a Kozai mechanism to have a misalignment which lasts as long as the lifetime of the system itself.
Well, if we're willing to assume that the planets start out aligned with the star, you still need some mechanism to produce the misalignment. What you're saying, though, is that tidal forces will not realign it in
exactly
a reasonable time.
For some cases.
Right.
So it depends really on the total angular momentum in the system and on the dissipation mechanism in the planet and in the star.
Okay.
If for some reason the planet is more dissipative than the star, then you do not expect the obliquity to be damped in the lifetime of the system. So I'm not very surprised that out of, I don't know, 50 or 60 transiting systems, you end up having three or four of these guys not being aligned.
Well, the fraction is uncertain, but it's probably more like 5 or 6 out of 20.
Oh, okay.
Okay, the last question in the back.
Actually, at some level, the last comment just addressed it. So I was a little concerned about the statistics. I mean, Jeff made this point, you know, that the claim was that it's consistent with all these planets being produced by Kozai. my reading of the situation is if you look at the radial velocity selected planets, you know, the fraction of those that show this misalignment is well, the first set that you were looking at early in time were all radial velocity selected, and they had low inclination angles. Hmm. And then if you look at the samples that are selected via transits, a larger fraction of those may well have these inclined orbits. So this, you may be selecting a different population of planets. There may be a selection of, there may be a population of very hot Jupiters, which you discover by transits, which are closer to the star, that may have been produced via COSI or some similar mechanism. And yet, a second population, or the first population historically, which is ones that are produced by dismigration, and which are discovered by radial velocities, that don't have such short periods, that tend to be more aligned. So that's at least a possibility. So it would be very interesting to find out what are the statistics of the fraction of the stars that you're looking at. What fraction have transiting planets? Okay, is it 1 in 1,000? In which case it could well be a totally separate population.
That's a good point. That reminds me that, like you said, there has been this gradual change from the really bright host stars, which we attacked first, to the fainter ones discovered by transit surveys. And those fainter ones tend to be hotter stars as well, with different outer structures, and that may be relevant as well to the time series.
Okay, on that note, we'll have to finish this presentation. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you. Oh, thanks.
Okay, our next speaker is Gaspar Bacos, who's going to review ground-based transit results. And we'll do